So, this is, I think, the second or third time we've had this great honor of introducing this amazing man, Monsignor Andrew Wadsworth, who was our special speaker tonight. You know, it wasn't too many years ago when he was a humble college professor, an expert in classics, a priest in the Diocese of Westminster, and a trained musician. Who was very much influenced by the work of Mary Mary, her spirit, as professor at this event. And in 2009, the most amazing thing happened. He was picked to be the executive director of ICEL. And he did something that most of us didn't think would ever happen in our lifetimes. He brought us, shepherded them into being a new Roman Missal, the one that now has been so much grace in my life in the last few years to get to know him as a friend and be inspired by his vision, his scholarship, his liberality, his charity, his generosity. It's an astonishing knowledge. He's been an important influence in the new direction that CMA has taken and worked with us and many other groups to bring a sense of peace to the world of liturgy, which he has taught me is the precondition for us all to prosper together. So it's my great pleasure to introduce a wonderful man, Monsignor Wadsworth.
Thank you, Jeffrey, and thank you, dear friends. It's in every sense a great pleasure to be here at the Colloquium once more. When the beloved Dove proposed to me the title of this talk that I'm about to give, and I should say, just in case anybody wonders, I'm not making a rather impious reference to the Holy Spirit. The beloved Dove in this case is Dove Pierce, our own faculty coordinator for the colloquium, who does so much throughout the year to put this wonderful colloquium together. In proposing the title of the Reform of the Roman Rite, a rather big topic, I of course immediately recognised there would be some wonderful opportunities to talk about things which we all feel very passionately about. In that, of course, I am preaching to the converted, or as I have learned to say over here, preaching to the choir, in every sense. But I do hope that beyond today's event, beyond this week, of course, it's not so much what we say and do here as important as it is, but it's what we take with us and what, through wonderful means of communication, is brought to the many others who learn about what we've done this week. That's the real importance and significance of our work here together. Who'd have thought a few short years ago that we would find ourselves at the cutting edge of liturgical renewal? Would have seemed unthinkable, really, I imagine. And, of course, it brings a wry smile when we say things like that. But increasingly, a rather nervous smile and laugh on the lips of those who don't share our understanding of things. When I'm in Rome, I hear very little these days about the reform of the reform. It just isn't within the arena of most people's awareness. In matters liturgical, if anything, we seem to be seeing something of a polarization. People have a vested interest in promoting this. Happily, though, not everyone is of this view. And I would like this evening to concentrate on one such person whose view, very fortunately for us, will be decisive. I refer, of course, to the Holy Father. Just 10 days ago, he addressed these thoughts to those gathered in Dublin for the 15th International Eucharistic Congress. This was in the form of a pre-recorded video message which was played at the end of the closing mass in Croke Park in Dublin. The Holy Father said, "The Eucharistic Congress occurs at a time when the Church throughout the world is preparing to celebrate the Year of Faith, to mark the 50th anniversary of the start of the Second Vatican Council, an event which launched the most extensive renewal of the Roman Rite ever known. Based upon a deepening appreciation of the sources of the liturgy, the Council promoted the full and active participation of the faithful in the Eucharistic sacrifice. At our distance today from the Council Fathers, expressed desires regarding liturgical renewal, and in the light of the Universal Church's experience in the intervening period, it is clear that a great deal has been achieved. But it is equally clear that there have been many misunderstandings and irregularities. The renewal of external forms desired by the Council Fathers was intended to make it easier to enter into the depth of the mystery. Its true purpose was to lead people to a personal encounter with the Lord, present in the Eucharist, and thus with the living God, so that through this contact with Christ's love, the love of his brothers and sisters for one another might also grow. Yet not infrequently, the revision of the liturgical reforms, has remained at an external level, and active participation has been confused with external activity. Hence, much still remains to be done on the path of real liturgical renewal." During our brief time together this evening, I propose to reflect with you on a few themes taken from this single recent utterance of the Holy Father, as I believe it is highly representative of his thought in relation to this all-important consideration. He refers to the Second Vatican Council as an event which launched the most extensive renewal of the Roman Rite ever known. Very few people could have foreseen the wholesale revision of the liturgy which would come in the wake of the Second Vatican Council. And certainly few could foresee that the unifying experience of a Latin liturgy would become entirely alien to most Catholics born in the last third of the 20th century. The unchangeable nature of this characteristic of the liturgy was a view largely shared by Blessed John Henry Newman, Monsignor Robert Hugh Benson, Monsignor Ronald Knox, and until the liturgical reform happened, also by Archbishop Fulton Sheen. Commentators after the Council, such as Father Joseph Jelinek, composer of the famous Psalm Tones, went as far as to say, "The Roman Rite, as we knew it, has been destroyed." The factors that fed into the liturgical reform after the Council were complex and in some ways not entirely contemporary. I think we must now admit that until relatively recently, there has been very little scholarship that is able to accurately identify the sources of the liturgical reform. In some cases, the scholarly opinions upon which some decisions were based do not stand well the test of time. We must hope that scholarly commentary, which unravels some of the mystery surrounding the making of the new liturgy, becomes more readily available in the near future. Whether or not we have any scholarly insight, it's a fact that many of us have lived in the Church through this period and have thereby accumulated a vast reservoir of experiences which, for good or ill, shape our perceptions in relation to the liturgy and guide our expectations when we consider what we would hope to find when we come together to worship God in the liturgy. While there is a sort of commonality to these observations across a wide spectrum of liturgical preference, it goes without saying that whether something is considered desirable or not will largely depend on your view of what the liturgy is meant to achieve. I have come to the view personally that there is very little agreement in this important matter, and many people proceed on what is essentially a privatized view of something which is by definition common property. The Holy Father told those gathered for the Eucharistic Congress that a great deal has been achieved. And I'm sure that that is in fact the case. There have been some very positive developments in the wake of the liturgical reforms that followed the Second Vatican Council. I would cite the following as examples. It's now a fact the liturgies of the sacred triduum, largely unknown to the previous generation, have now become the liturgical heart of the year for most Catholics. The liturgy of the hours, previously largely limited to the clergy, has become more genuinely the prayer of the Church and the experience of both religious and lay people. A wider selection of readings in the Mass and all the sacramental rites have strengthened the idea that Scripture is part of the primitive liturgical kerygma. In those places where the principles of the liturgical movement have been applied to music, there is a greater appreciation of the various functions of music in the different elements of the liturgy. The revision of the rites of Christian initiation has led to a greater understanding of baptism as the foundational fact of our ecclesial identity. Where provision has been made for individual confession, there has been a return to the centrality of the sacrament of penance in the personal journey of conversion. The renewal of the rite of the worship of the Blessed Eucharist outside of Mass has facilitated, if not quite inspired, the widespread adoption of Eucharistic adoration as a standard element of parish life and as an important means of engendering private prayer. Of course, the Holy Father also commented that it is equally clear that there have been many misunderstandings and irregularities. A sense of the communion of the Church in the hearts of many has become limited to local communities that are in very many ways self-selecting. Many Catholics have a poorer understanding of what it means to belong to the universal Church, but a very highly developed understanding of what it means to belong to a self-selecting parish community of people like themselves. Any notion of the shape of the liturgical year has been greatly lessened by the ironing out of those features which characterize the distinctive seasons of the Church's year. The transference of solemnities which are holy days of obligation to Sundays destroys the internal dynamics of the liturgical cycle. Such is the case and creates havoc in the liturgy of the hours. We think particularly of the moving of the Epiphany and quite incomprehensibly of the Ascension. The universal ignoring of the singing of the propers of the Mass has created in many people's minds an idea that any amount of music from any source is acceptable in the Church's liturgy. The frequent tendency to gloss or paraphrase the liturgical texts, supplying continuous commentary, has contributed to an improvised or spontaneous character in much liturgical celebration. The multiplication of liturgical ministries has led to considerable confusion and error concerning the relationship between the ministerial priesthood and the common priesthood of the baptized. The liturgy often seems to have the quality of a performance, with the priest and liturgical ministers cast in the role of performers and behaving accordingly. Consequently, congregations are often expecting to be entertained, rather as spectators might be in a theatre. The manner of the distribution and reception of Holy Communion, including the appropriateness of one's reception of communion at a particular mass, has generally led to a casual disregard for this great sacrament. A proliferation of communion services presided over by lay people has resulted in a lessening of the sense of the importance of the Eucharistic sacrifice. The appalling banality of much liturgical music and the lack of any true liturgical spirit in the use of music in the liturgy has been a primary generating force in creating an anti-liturgical culture. The Holy Father goes on to note that not infrequently the revision of liturgical forms has remained at an external level, and active participation has been confused with external activity. This, I believe, is the very crux of the matter. And I would like to illustrate it this evening with reference to the Mass at which Pope Benedict's remarks were in fact heard, the closing Mass of the recent Eucharistic Congress in Dublin. The improvements in the liturgical culture, particularly improvements in liturgical music, which have become increasingly evident throughout this papacy, particularly in large-scale celebrations, was sadly almost entirely absent from this occasion, giving the event a sort of retro 80s feel. More specifically, the entire liturgy did have a performance quality to it, with the assembly as the principal focus. This was borne out by the fact that many musical items were greeted with applause, just as in a performance. There was frequent disregard for the provisions of the general instruction of the Roman Missal. This was particularly evident with reference to music. None of the antiphons of the proper were sung for the entrance, offertory, and communion processions. Gregorian chant was conspicuous by its absence. None of the Missal chants was used for the people's parts of the order of the Mass, with the single exceptions of the Gospel and Preface Dialogues. Even though this Mass was predominantly in English, and these chants would have been well known by most of the people present. In the profession of faith, after the cardinal celebrant had intoned Credo III, individual lectors read the Apostles' Creed, which of course has a different intonation to the Nicene Creed, and they read in a series of languages spoken paragraphs which were punctuated by the sung response, Credo, Amen. This, to my knowledge, is not recognizably one of the modes for the Creed described in the general instruction of the Roman Missal. Much of the music did not correspond to the spirit of the liturgical action, the requirement of paragraph 41 of the general instruction. For instance, there was a celebratory spot during the distribution of Holy Communion when three clerical tenors, the priests, sang the impossibly sentimental song, May the Road Rise Up to Meet You. What is wrong with the communion antiphon and its song? Despite the international character of this occasion, the use of Latin and the people sung parts was almost entirely non-existent. The depressing cumulative effect of the disregard of all of these principles in a major liturgy celebrated by a papal legate and broadcast throughout the world is hard to underestimate. If I were given to conspiracy theories, I would almost feel persuaded that this was a deliberately calculated attempt to broadcast a different message and to oppose the better liturgical spirit of recent times. But surely it cannot be so. I think we have to ask such questions, and indeed to surmise that the influence of former barons of the liturgical establishment has found a new and conspicuous area of activity in which to model their example of poor liturgy. There can be no talk of the reform of the Roman Rite until the general instruction of the Roman Missal is enforced, at least as a minimum requirement. If it remains a largely fantasy text at the beginning of our autumn missals, then the rebuilding of the broken-down city will take a very long time indeed. The Holy Father concluded by saying that much still remains to be done on the path of real liturgical renewal. We must conclude by agreeing with the Holy Father. There is much to be done. And happily, a week like this one is a prophetic sign of the new liturgical roadmap, where we are going and how we shall be doing it. In an attempt to engender ongoing improvement in the quality of our liturgy, and in the hope that Catholics will be able to encounter a liturgy that is self-evidently expressive of our liturgical tradition and conveys a sense of something larger than the purely local, in a highly personal view, I would identify the following as desirable characteristics of the liturgy of the future. Firstly, and essentially, a sense of reverence for the text. The unity of the Roman Rite is now essentially a textual unity. The Church permits a certain latitude in the interpretation of the liturgical norms that govern the celebration of the liturgy. And hence, our unity within the Roman Rite is essentially textual. We use the same prayers and meditate on the same scriptures. This now is happily rather more evident as we use a single English text throughout the English-speaking world. A greater willingness to heed sacrosanctum concilium rather than continual recourse to the rather nebulous concept of the spirit of the council, which generally attempts to legitimize liturgical abuses rather than correct them. Currently, these teachings are more likely to be evidenced in a well-prepared presentation of the extraordinary form than most ordinary formal celebrations. It need not be so. In relation to both forms of the Roman Rite, a careful attention to the demands of the calendar and the norms which govern the celebration of the liturgy, not assuming that it is possible or acceptable to depart from these norms. I would suggest that a rereading of Pius XII's wonderful encyclical Mediator Dei, in conjunction with more recent magisterial documents, would be a very good guide. In this way, the light of tradition might be perceived to shine on all our liturgical celebrations. We need to see the widespread cultivation of a dignified and reverent liturgy that evidences careful preparation and respect for its constituent elements in accordance with the Church's norms. We need to see a recovery of the Latin tradition of the Roman Rite that enables us to continue to present elements of our liturgical patrimony from the earliest centuries with understanding. This necessarily requires a far more enthusiastic and widespread commitment to the teaching and learning of Latin. I would say that because I'm a Latin teacher. In order that the linguistic culture required for interpreting our texts and our chants may more widely be experienced and our patrimony enjoy a greater constituency. Importantly, there must be a far greater commitment to silence before, during, and after the celebration of the liturgy. This, in some places, is entirely absent, with rather dire consequences. Importantly, we must seek to see the exclusion of all music which does not have a liturgical voice, regardless of style. That's an important consideration. We tend to think of it all being contemporary music, but it is not so. There are plenty of pieces of the classical and romantic period that are entirely unsuitable for liturgical use. We must seek also to see the elimination from the liturgy of music which only expresses secular culture and is ill-suited to the demands of the liturgy. A renaissance of interest in and use of chant in both Latin and English, as a recognition that this form of music should enjoy first place in our liturgy, and all other musical forms are suitable for liturgical use to the extent that they share in the characteristics of the chant, would be a very good first step. An avoidance of the idea that music is the sole consideration in the liturgy. The music is a vehicle for the liturgy, not the other way around. A commitment to the celebration and teaching of the Ars Celebrandi of both forms of the Roman Rite, so that all our priests can perceive more readily how the light of tradition shines on our liturgical life, and how this might be communicated more effectively to all our people. We need to see a clearer distinction between devotions, non-liturgical forms of prayer, and the sacred liturgy. A lack of any proper liturgical sense has led to a proliferation of devotions as an alternative vehicle for popular fervour. This was a widespread criticism of the liturgy before the council, and now we have to ask ourselves why the same lacuna has been identified in the newer liturgical reforms. Having travelled the English-speaking world very widely in preparation for the implementation of the English translation of the third typical edition of the Missale Romano, and having experienced the liturgy in a wide variety of circumstances and styles, I would conclude that I have genuinely encountered a very great desire for change, although not always among those who are directly responsible for the liturgy. I think we are currently well placed to respond to this desire, and this is evidenced by the fact that many things which were indicated 50 years ago, such as the singing of the Mass, and more particularly the singing of the proper texts, rather than the endless substitution of songs and hymns, are only now being seriously considered and implemented. It is earnestly to be desired that such developments continue to flourish, and that an improved liturgical culture is accessible to everyone in the church. Crucial to this peaceful revolution has been the leadership and example of the present Holy Father, who has consistently studied and written about the liturgy in a long life of scholarship, which now informs his governance of the Church's liturgical life. Much that he commends was already evident in aspects of liturgical scholarship from the early 20th century onwards. In our own time, however, it is finally being received with the joy and enthusiasm that it merits. A new generation of Catholics eagerly awaits a greater experience of the basic truth that the liturgy is always a gift which we must receive from the Church rather than make for ourselves. The Church Music Association of America, all those who identify with its initiatives and benefit from its prophetic lead, have a very serious and highly significant contribution to make to this process. May God bless us all as we share in this world.